My topic today pertains COPD phenotypes, and it's actually a hot topic, but it's also a topic that is in progress, so we don't know too much about it. I'm going to try to share with you what we know about COPD phenotypes. Why is it important for every clinician pulmonologist to know about this? And maybe share with you at the end what we should do in the future or what we should elucidate. So these are my disclosures. I do receive grants and research grants from different entities, none of which really pertain to today's talk. So this is where our old look of COPD was, the blue bloater, pink puffer. We still see these pictures in textbooks when you talk about COPD. And the perception for many years has been that COPD is a disease of old men, and it's also a disease of elderly. And that perception now has been shown not to be true. In fact, it's a disease of middle-aged men and women. In fact, in the United States, more women are diagnosed with COPD and die from COPD than men. But also, in your clinic, you may see patients like these. These are four patients with very similar FEV1, less than 35%. But if you look at their clinical characteristics, they're quite distinct in their exercise tolerance, oxygenation, BMI, and dyspnea index using MRC. So we know upfront that COPD is not a one-face disease, and these faces of disease are called phenotypes. In fact, we know that if you do CT scans on patients with COPD, you may see patients with predominant emphysema, but you may also see patients with predominant airway disease, and you may see patients with both. Indeed, when you look at patients physically, and we'll talk about obesity and COPD later on this afternoon, but you see some patients with very low BMI, cachectic, who carry worse prognosis, but you also see patients with metabolic syndrome. And also, when you ask patients, what do? You'll see two ends of the spectrum. Some of my patients with FEV1 of 30%, they still do their daily activities. On the other hand, some cannot do anything, and they're just watching TV all day. So there's definitely, from the clinical just observation, there are differences between COPD. But to be more scientific, we sort of came up with these terms, meaning the scientific community, the phenotype and endotype, and it's true for both asthma and COPD. And the definition of phenotype relates to a single or combination of attributes that describe differences between individuals. Now, a phenotype has to be clinically meaningful, otherwise it's useless. Some phenotypes may be based on symptoms, exacerbations, disease progression, response to therapy, and survival. Now, what are some of the things we use to define phenotypes? There are several, which I'll share with you in a minute. But before that, let me ask a question. Why should we even bother to phenotype patients with COPD? Well, for several reasons. One, it really enhances our understanding of the disease process, the treatment, and outcome. It certainly allows us to distinctly classify patients in different buckets so that it will help us choose the right treatment for the right person, but also give us a prognosis of the different subgroups. It allows us for enrichment in clinical trials. Right now, clinical trials in COPD enroll any smokers with airway obstruction and without really subclassifying phenotypes. And we've had some examples where some drugs failed to show an effect when you do that, but when you select certain phenotype, the drug worked. And then finally, most important, is we want to improve outcomes from this third leading cause of death in the United States and the fifth in the world. So there are several phenotypic dimensions. I'll mention a few because of the time, but there are clinical phenotypes that have been defined, particularly the chronic bronchitis and the asthma-COPD overlap, and the exacerbator phenotypes. These are the three I'm going to discuss in details. There are physiologic phenotypes based on the airflow obstruction, small airway dysfunction, or others. There are a radiologic phenotype, which I will spend a few minutes on, because these are important, although mainly in research right now, but we learned a lot about those in the last few years. There are phenotypes related to systemic inflammation. And then finally, there are phenotypes related to comorbidities, one of which we will discuss at the end of the day today on obesity as a phenotype of COPD. So when you look at what we know about phenotypes in COPD, you can see that we have multiple faces, at least right now in the 2017 era. We have defined several subgroups of patients with COPD, some of which we're still looking at, but these are some examples of phenotypes out there. Let me start with one that is very clinically defined, chronic bronchitis, patients with cough and sputum. What have we learned about chronic bronchitis patients compared to other COPD patients? This slide comes from the COPD gene study. We are involved in this study. We are 20 centers in the United States looking at a large group of COPD patients and smokers without COPD. And we looked at different things, and many papers came out of the COPD gene study, one of which is this one, where we looked at patients who self-report chronic cough and sputum, meaning having chronic bronchitis. And we found that patients with chronic bronchitis compared to those with no cough and sputum tend to have more symptoms, worse quality of life, and a worse body index. But more important, and this has been replicated by other studies, that patients with chronic bronchitis do have increased risk of exacerbation compared to those who don't. So asking the patient, do you have cough and sputum with COPD, puts him or her at higher risk of exacerbation than those who don't. Another clinically defined phenotype that we're still scratching our head about is this asthma COPD overlap. Notice I took syndrome off because now the current guidelines do not recognize this as a syndrome. And in fact, it's a mixed bag of definition when you look at ACO. Asthma COPD overlap. There are patients with asthma who have a COPD component, but from the COPD point of view, some patients with COPD have an asthma component. And what are the clinical scenarios when you can see this? There are several, but these are potential clinical scenarios where there may be an overlap with COPD with asthma, such as patients who have COPD defined physiologically, but also report past history of asthma before age 40, who have clinical features of asthma, such as episodic nature of disease, elevated IgE, elevated eosinophils, variability of airway obstruction, bronchodilator response, and evidence of eosinophilic airway inflammation. Well, the Spanish, our colleagues in Spain, were actually the first to come up with criteria to diagnose ACO, and they later on revised these criteria. These are the latest revisions from their criteria, and they came up with major and minor criteria based on their consensus. There's no good evidence, but they came up with these, that if there is one major criteria or two minor criteria, that would define ACO. As you see here, the major criteria are based on previous history of asthma, marked reversibility of bronchodilators. Minor criteria include IgE level, history of atopy, reversibility on two separate occasions, and blood eosinophils. In previous criteria, they put sputum eosinophils, but that's something that is very hard to do in the real life. What about other consensus about defining asthma COPD overlap? This is the latest paper from a round table discussion between US and European and Canadian colleagues. And they came up with a similar sort of major minor criteria. I won't go through this for the sake of time, but just to show you that we still don't have a consensus, or even the GINA and GOLD guidelines don't have an exact definition of what is asthma COPD overlap. More importantly is, what is the clinical implication? For me as a clinician, what does it mean if I see a COPD with an asthma component? Well, I think the most important clinical implication is really that many studies, at least retrospective studies, cross-sectional studies, show that patients with an asthma component of COPD tend to have worse outcomes than patients with just COPD. But more important is the treatment. These patients should be treated with inhaled steroids early. And if they don't have an asthma component, inhaled steroids may not be needed early, actually. And that's something that the GOLD guidelines now embrace. The limitation of what we have is that all what we know is based on expert opinion. There are only a few prospective studies looking at this phenotype of the disease. The third clinical phenotype is very important. It's also defined by history, so you don't have to spend money to define that phenotype, and that's the frequent exacerbator phenotype. And we learned a lot about this from the ECLIPSE study, which we participated in. This was a longitudinal three-year COPD study where we followed patients for 3 years, looking at different mediators and also intermediate biomarkers and others, including radiologic. But what we found in this ECLIPSE study is that a patient who has or reports frequent exacerbation, more than two in the preceding year, has the highest risk of having an exacerbation in the subsequent years. But also there is a repeatability, so that patients with history of recurrent exacerbation tend to have history of recurrent exacerbation in year two and three, as opposed to those who don't have or don't report exacerbator. From the same study, in a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Hurst and colleagues reported that a patient who reports history of exacerbation the previous year has almost six odds ratio of having frequent exacerbation. So that's easily defined. And why is it important? Because these patients tend to have worse outcomes. Frequent exacerbations can increase risk of decline in lung function, even mortality, and also hospital admission. So what about other phenotypes? Well, there are some radiologic phenotypes, and I have to say that I'm not advocating doing CT scans on every COPD patient you have. This is all in research in progress. There are now good protocols to actually measure airway thickness and also lung density, both inspiratory and expiratory in COPD. But we know that radiologically, these patients don't behave the same way. Notice that these patients, two patients, have similar FEV1, but their CT scans show one emphysema more, the other one shows airway more. And in fact, now with the technology we have, we can actually quantify the emphysema, quantify the gas trapping, quantify the airway thickness. And many studies have been published actually looking at these type of quantification, including CT quantitative imaging. You can see that radiologically, you can define COPD in different ways, quantitatively, but also visually. And there are several papers that have identified subphenotypes based on radiologic manifestations of COPD, both emphysema and also airway subphenotypes, which I don't have really time to go through. I'm just going to give you a couple of examples from studies published in the last few years. This is from our COPD gene study, looking at 1,000 patients with COPD subjects, looking at their CT scan, and some patients had more emphysema, as you see here on the axis, and others have airway thickness. But the fact is, what we found is that patients with significant airway thickness tend to have higher exacerbation, but on the other hand, patients with higher percent emphysema tend to have higher exacerbations. But these are not the same group, as you see from the graph. Another study looking at bronchiectasis, which is very common radiologic finding in COPD. Even though these patients have COPD, they have bronchiectatic features on CT scan, and the clinical implication of finding bronchiectasis on CT scan is important because these indeed patients have higher history of exacerbations. And one of the clinical implications may be that you may treat them early with antibiotics or prophylactic antibiotics, but certainly many studies have shown that these patients have worse outcomes compared to those without bronchiectasis. This is the last example radiologically before I show you some interesting biomarker radiologically that we're looking at. This is a study looking at the aorta and the pulmonary artery diameters and looking at correlating the aortic and PA ratio with exacerbation of COPD, which was very interesting because it was replicated in two large cohorts. So it's not just a haphazard finding. In this study, they showed that the pulmonary artery diameter over aortic diameter, if it's more than one, it predicted increased risk of exacerbation. The exact mechanism for this is still unknown, but it is something that people are looking at. More interestingly, right now, the CT scan, the technology allows us to do what we call parametric response map, and actually using certain radiologic findings as biomarkers to predict emphysema or small airway disease, as you see on this slide. And indeed, you can quantify using this biomarker whether a patient has a progression of the disease from normal, like here in green, to severe emphysema in red, to the yellow, which reflects a small airway disease. This PRM, or parametric response map, has been used in several studies, and it is still in the research arena, but I think something that is important to keep in mind. In the future, it may be something that we can utilize to predict progression of the disease in some of these patients. So in summary, quantitative CT scan phenotyping is an important yet research tool right now to identify several phenotypes of COPD. Certain findings correlate with clinical symptoms, exacerbations. I didn't show you with osteoporosis, but studies have shown that emphysema and osteoporosis correlate very nicely. It's still a research tool, and the selection, it may help us select candidates for certain interventions like lung volume reduction surgery, but there are lots of potential future clinical implications. The other phenotypes I wanted to mention is the systemically inflamed phenotype, and this was described by Alvar Agusti from Barcelona from the ECLIPSE study, where he showed that patients with COPD, here shown on the left of the screen, compared to smokers, tend to have increased levels of circulating systemic biomarkers of inflammation, including TNF-alpha, IL-8, IL-6, and C-reactive protein. What he also found, and that when you follow these patients, patients with highly, or what he called persistently inflamed phenotype, they tend to persist over time, even when you follow them after 1 year. And those who don't have any biomarkers elevated, the ones in the orange, they continue not to have it after 1 year. So there's a sort of a consistently persistent inflamed and consistently persistently non-inflamed phenotype. What's more interesting is they found that patients with systemically inflamed phenotype tend to have a higher prevalence of current smoking, a higher BMI. They tend to be older and have worse quality of life. But more important, those with persistent systemic inflammation tend to have higher mortality, all-cause mortality, and higher exacerbation. Now, obviously, right now, we don't take blood from our COPD patients to check for these systemic biomarkers of inflammation, partly because it's still in research tool, but it may be we may reach to a stage where we may check systemic inflammation in these patients, because indeed, if this study is replicated, then we may see that these patients are at higher risk of exacerbations. When another study published in JAMA also replicated the fact that patients with high systemic biomarker of inflammation tend to have higher exacerbation, and the more biomarkers that have been elevated, like three or more, tend to be associated with 80% increased risk of exacerbation. Now, talking about systemic inflammation, let's talk about eosinophilic COPD, which is my last phenotype I want to discuss. This is still in the pipeline. You know, the blood eosinophilia has been shown, at least in retrospective study, in COPD to correlate with inhaled steroid response. Has been shown in retrospective studies, but has not really been replicated in a prospective studies, so it's still up in the air. In the WISDOM trial, where they withdrew inhaled steroids from patients on triple drug, inhaled steroid, LABA, and tiotropium, they found that those patients who exacerbated when you withdraw inhaled steroids were those with high blood eosinophils at baseline, more than 400 cells per microliter, suggesting that those, if you check blood eosinophils in these patients with COPD, it may predict response to inhaled steroids, but also those are the ones you don't want to take off their inhaled steroid if they're already on them. And so therefore, there are certain drugs now being looked at to target this TH2 or T2 pathway, one of which is an anti-IL-5, which is being tested, that has shown in at least phase 2 trials that it may decrease exacerbations if patients' blood eosinophils is high more than 300. And then the last phenotype, actually, I want to just briefly mention quickly because I'm running out of time, is those patients with normal airway obstruction, but symptoms. This is actually, we don't know if we call it COPD because these patients are not obstructed, but they have history of smoking and chronic cough and sputum. I call it gold zero, although gold took off that stage many years ago. We've done several studies, one of them from COPD gene study, suggesting that these patients tend to have actually more symptoms and worse outcomes, both dyspnea outcomes and also exacerbation, than patients who don't have symptoms, even though they are not obstructed. And indeed, one large paper that came in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, looking at another cohort from the Spiromics large cohort database, suggesting that these patients with smoking but non-obstructive, they call them non-obstructive bronchitis, have actually high CAT scores compared to those patients who are controls, who are smokers without symptoms, and those who never smoked. And they actually looked further in this cohort, and they found that these patients tend to be on medications, even though they are not obstructed physiologically. They tend to be on 42% use bronchodilators, 23% use inhaled corticosteroid, even though they had preserved lung function, but they were symptomatic. Indeed, the question remains is, what's the natural history of these patients? Are they COPD? Are they going to progress to have COPD? Should we be treating them? And this is a focus of an NIH project we're just starting called Rethink, which actually is looking at LAMA-LABA, early treatment of these symptomatic non-obstructive patients who I don't know if I should call COPD to see if they can affect their outcomes with treating them early. So what's the bottom line? Why do we phenotype? And I want to summarize is that there are therapeutic implications. These are examples where phenotyping has helped us identify certain treatments. For example, PDE4 inhibitor, roflumilast, only works in those with chronic bronchitis and a patient with history of exacerbation. Inhaled steroids really work best in those patients with history of exacerbation. Long-term oxygen therapy only works in those with hypoxemic COPD, and so on. Lung volume reduction surgery work best in those with upper lobe predominant emphysema with poor exercise tolerance. And we talked about the eosinophilic COPD. Well, the Spanish were the first to come up with criteria for ACOL, but also were the first one to incorporate phenotypes in their guidelines. Now, this is not encroached or at least adopted by the GOLD guidelines, although the GOLD guidelines mention phenotypes multiple times, but they have not incorporated phenotypes in the step-up approach with therapy like the Spanish. But I thought I should share with you that that may be the trend in the future once we have finalized identified all the phenotypes. So to summarize, what I tried to convey to you this morning is that phenotyping COPD is important. It's still work in progress. We have identified certain phenotypes, the clinical ones that we know of. There are several tools to identify phenotypes, clinical, physiologic, radiologic, and biologic. And a phenotype without a clear implication clinically is useless and should really not be even further investigated. Frequent exacerbators and patients with emphysema, patients with chronic bronchitis are just some example of phenotypes that have been identified. And then quantitative chest CT is helpful in identifying radiologic phenotypes, which may have clinical and therapeutic implication. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you, Professor, for this excellent and clear topic. And we move to questions.
Thank you very much for keeping our interest in COPD again after giving up for several years. Two questions very fast.
One is probably teleological. Why do we have the definition of COPD exacerbation so loose? Anybody whose medications have been increased or
seen? Yes.
I don't think, in my opinion and practice, I should be calling it an exacerbation and blame, put, honing down and calling the patient has had two exacerbations
yes.
a year. Mine would be hospitalization as an exacerbation. Uh-huh. The second is, have we looked at any time of phenotyping by alpha-1 antitrypsin levels as they fluctuate and possible genetic implication of this? Thank you.
Yes. Well, the COPD exacerbation definition actually is more robust now than it used to be, I hope you agree, 10 years ago, where we had really very fluid definition. Right now, the definition is any patient with COPD who has increase in symptoms beyond day-to-day variability that require treatment changes. And it's further divided into mild, moderate, severe. In those mild COPD exacerbations, which usually are not captured in clinical trials, are those who may need increased use of rescue medication, or the moderate ones are the ones who need oral or oral steroids or antibiotics. And the severe exacerbations are those who require hospital admission. So that's how we define it universally in clinical trials, at least, and also in our clinical field. Why did they pick two or more? It's really based on the ECLIPSE data. They showed that those patients with two or more exacerbation, or one hospitalization, if you remember the COPD guidelines, they say the patients who are at high risk are those with two exacerbations the past year or one hospital admission. So one hospital admission puts the patient in the bracket of the grade D. We didn't talk about the grading here. So it's important. I'm glad you brought up hospital admission. The second question, and I apologize not mentioning alpha-1. I'm not undermining. This is a very important cause of emphysema, although not common. It is one type of phenotyping in a way that if you have pan-lobular emphysema on X-ray, emphysema in the lower lobe, you should think, you know, and the lower alpha-1 antitrypsin. That's a very good example of a phenotype that is genetically determined. And indeed, the role of genomics, which we did not mention here, is very important and may actually contribute to our knowledge in phenotyping these patients in the future. Currently, we are trying to identify, that's the whole purpose of COPD gene, is trying to identify the genes that may predict who among smokers will develop COPD, because only 20% of smokers get COPD, as you know.
Yes.
Question.
This way. Yes, thank you, sir. Professor. I'm actually impressed you got funding for a study on Gold Zero. It's, what is the outcome measure
right.
that you can prove that would make it cost effective to give long-acting beta agonist and long-acting muscarinic
right.
in a patient that has normal spirometry, probably goes to work and everything. And,
yeah, they're symptomatic, though.
They are symptomatic, but yeah. then again, you're going to justify giving them a costly medication,
yes.
quote-unquote. You
yeah.
have to prove cost-effectiveness. This has been the problem because it's going to be a huge long-term study.
Absolutely. So this is, first of all, I am one of the sites participating in this Rethink study. It's the PI is from Michigan, not me. Dr. Han, Melan Han, is the PI. And her hypothesis is based on the fact that I showed you that in real life, many of these symptomatic smokers without airway obstructions are already on bronchodilators, and many of them are on inhaled steroids. And the question is whether we treat them with bronchodilators and many of them have exacerbations, call it, and whether we treat them early, we can reduce these episodes of exacerbation and healthcare utilization. But you're right. I don't think we're going to prevent by using a LABA/LAMA decline in lung function or causing COPD. The study is not actually powerful enough or long enough
exactly.
to detect whether we're going to prevent the onset of COPD. It's more looking at symptoms and quality of life more than anything. I have the same apprehension, but you know, many of the studies we've done, we started with. If you asked me 20 years ago, is there a role for inhaled steroids in COPD, I would be laughing, you know. But there is. We tested it, and we showed that there is. In a subgroup, they do get better. So we'll see what happens. But I had the same apprehension you had, and I think the NIH bought it into and funded it, so it's funded by NIH. And hopefully we can report on it in maybe a couple of years' time.
Question?
Regarding the ECOS.
ECO.
What we have seen in the criteria to define it, is it's asthma. I mean, well, they only are smokers, and then the, well, that doesn't mean the. I mean, minor and major criteria is.
Yeah, but these are physiologically COPD. So the post-bronchodilator FEV1, FVC, less than 0.7. They're smokers. They have fixed airway, well, definition physiologically of COPD plus history of asthma. But you're right. It's a mixed bag. That's why we don't call it a syndrome anymore. And there's actually a very nice paper in New England maybe last year or a year and a half ago on ACOS. And it shows you that even within ACOS, there are at least four groups. There are the smokers with asthma, what do you call those? There are those asthmatics who had asthma long-term and then now have fixed airway obstruction because of remodeling. Is that ACOS? There are the smoker. There are the COPD patient with eosinophilia, and then the COPD patient with significant bronchodilator response. So there is more than one subgroup within the ECHO. The only clinical implication, to be honest right now, is the use of inhaled steroids early in these patients, and maybe not to justify using it early if they don't have that subgroup.
One last question.
Yes, sir.
Besides the ECHO's syndrome, do you have any advantage to give inhaled steroid to COPD in the other phenotypes?
Well, there's lots of discussion about inhaled steroids. For many years, GOLD guidelines embraced inhaled steroid in those with severe disease and those with history of exacerbation. But now with the LABA/LAMAs being very popular and being studied very widely, and we have at least four of them in the U.S., I'm sure you have several here, LABA/LAMAs at least have shown to be effective in reducing exacerbations, as effective and in some studies more effective than ICS/LABA. So therefore, and because of the increased concern about risk of pneumonia and side effects with inhaled corticosteroids, we started holding off. We started thinking, okay, is it justified to give everybody with COPD, even if they have history of exacerbation, inhaled steroids? And the answer is no. So people try to look at, okay, who among those patients with history of exacerbation may benefit the most? One is the patient with ECHO. Two is possibly those with high baseline eosinophilia on blood tests, although, again, I would underline that this is based on retrospective studies. The concern is the side effects. And I think right now, if you look at the latest GOLD 2017 guidelines, they've actually... And I was a reviewer for these guidelines, and I had a criticism anyway because there's not too much evidence, but they have really pushed inhaled steroid LABA and put LABA/LAMA as the first thing after giving a long-acting bronchodilator in patients who continue to have symptoms. So you first go with a long-acting bronchodilator, then a LABA/LAMA first, and then they mentioned consider ICS/LABA, but they don't give you specifics when. So it's an option, but it's not the next step like it used to be before.